Please welcome Foster Ackerman.
Thank you, Alan, and welcome everybody today. I appreciate your coming out and fighting the parking lot woes. I want to talk about the hidden history of horse racing. This was an absolutely fun book to research. We don't talk about Keeneland and we don't talk about the Red Mile because they are current. What this book talks about are the racetracks that used to be in Lexington and Louisville and in Kentucky. And in particular, we're going to start talking about African-American jockeys who, after the Civil War, became America's first professional athlete class. These riders would go from track to track, work for trainer and owner, some of them on retainer. They made the equivalent of NBA basketball salaries for that time period. We're going to talk about a church in Lexington that was built by horses. We're going to talk about how the Oaks and the Derby got their name, and it's really the Kentucky Preakness, really, and I'll explain that. Here are the six jockeys that I talk about in the book. Alonzo Clayton was the youngest jockey to ride in the Kentucky Derby. Oliver Lewis won the Kentucky Derby, won the very first Kentucky Derby, as a matter of fact, which is why he earns a street named after him west of Lexington, west of downtown. In a later life, he became a bookie, where he put his training and knowledge of horse flesh to work setting odds. And if you've never encountered a bookie, and none of us will admit that in the United States today, you'd have to say I went to England to bookies. Tracks don't set odds. Individual bookies set their own odds, and that'll change from time to time. And more about that later. And I have a chapter on how betting evolved in the United States from wagers between individuals to the highly computerized exotic system we have today. Isaac Murphy in 1887 was America's highest paid athlete. He made $12,000. $1,000 a month was real good. His 14% win record still stands. He won 628 races in just over 1,400 rides. You got Jimmy Soup Perkins down there. He was the leading jockey in 1897. He got his nickname Soup because the family lived near the stables of the old Kentucky Association track at 5th and Race Streets running up to the northeast. In downtown, what is now downtown Lexington. It was the edge of town at the time. In fact, at the time, city limits were determined to be 1 mile radius from the center of the old courthouse. And as it happened, the clubhouse and the finish line were inside the city limits, but the betting sheds were in the county where there was no ordinance against gambling. So you would leave the city, walk out into the county, place your bet, come on back. Back in that area where the stables were, and the Perkins family lived near there, and he hung out, picking up part-time jobs in the stables, and he'd walk home for lunch. And when he came back after lunch, they'd say, Jimmy, what'd you have for lunch? He'd say, Soup. Due course of time, he became Soup Perkins. And then Willie Sims on the bottom right was the number one rider in 1893. He also earned over $12,000 in his best year. But my favorite jockey is Jimmy Wingfield. Now, Jimmy was born in Charlesburg, Fayette County. There is no hamlet of Charlesburg left, but we have the Walnut Hill Charlesburg Road, which used to run, and you could figure out about where Charlesburg is from there. He was born there in 1882. His first ride was at age 16 in Chicago. It was a travesty. He had no idea what he was doing. He ran off track. It was horrible. But 2 years later, he had been trained to be a jockey. 1901, he won his first Kentucky Derby and 160 other races that year. The next year, he wins the Kentucky Derby again, riding Alan Adale, a very famous thoroughbred. He was the only African-American jockey to win the Derby in the 20th century. There were several who won in the 19th century, but things began happening around 1900. He was the last African-American jockey to ride in the Derby. Now, the reason all that changed is that the Jim Crow era swept its way across the country, segregated facilities, segregated activities, segregated places, restaurants, bars, and eventually the white jockeys began pushing the black jockeys out of the business, and the white trainers stopped hiring the black jockeys. In Jimmy's case, he made a serious mistake. He won the Kentucky Derby in 01 and 1902. In 1903, a fellow by the name of John E. Madden hires Wingfield to ride for him in a particular race, and Wingfield agrees to do this. The mistake, he turned around and took a higher fee from a different owner to ride against Madden's horse and beat him. Madden was furious and made the threat, "You'll never ride in the United States again." And he dropped from over 600 races a year to under 20 races in the next 12 months. And so he did what so many other black jockeys had done and left for the racetracks in Europe where there was no segregation. And he started riding in England and then in France, started getting more rides. By 1910, he's not riding in the United States at all, not even trying to get back for the big races here. In due course of time, and this is where it gets fun, he becomes the lead jockey for Tsar Nicholas II, who has hundreds of horses. He has a big apartment across the square from the Kremlin. He marries a white Russian duchess. He has a white butler and eventually a couple of sons. He's winning all over Europe and Russia. He wins the Warsaw Derby twice, the Russian Oaks five times. Did you know the Russians had an Oaks? Well, they did. They had the Russian Derby as well. He won that four times. In one year, he won the Russian equivalent of the Triple Crown, the Moscow, Warsaw, and St. Petersburg Derbies. I mean, this guy is on top of the world, all right? Then there's this one problem that crops up. The Russian revolutionaries didn't like rich men's sports. And when the Russian Revolution came in 1917 and the Bolsheviks came to power, Jimmy had to flee. And he took his wife and his three children and 260 of the Tsar's best horses and starts walking them across Europe, first to Poland, and then as things calm down, on across Europe to Normandy, where he gets a farm and sets up his own training and breeding facility with the Tsar's horses. Because by this time, the Romanovs are dead, and there's nobody to give the horses back to. So he keeps them and sets up a tremendous career in France. He rides until 1930 at age 48. He died at age 93 in 1974 and was inducted into the Thoroughbred Hall of Fame in 2004. So that's Jimmy Wickfield, and he's quite a character. I had the honor of being asked by the Keeneland gift shop to sit and sell books and autograph them at the spring meet this year. And this black fella comes up to me and looks at my book. He says, "Do you know who Jimmy Wingfield was?" And I said, "Oh, yes." And I gave him just enough information to let him know I did. And he said, "He is Wingfield's grandson and has memorabilia. And I've been trying to find him ever since to work on a biography of Wingfield, because my editor said, yes, I'd love to see something like that, but I can't get the guy. There's a, you know, the voice message is full." Anyway, emails come back. Well, let's talk about the church that horses built. If you all are conversant with Lexington churches, or at least downtown, that's the Church of the Good Shepherd at Belcourt and East Main Street. The year was 1923. Legislatures across the country had been outlawing pari-mutuel wagering. Now, this was part of the progressive movement that led to prohibition, led to shutting down red light districts. Now they're trying to go after betting. And they had good intentions. Too many, betting was conducted in saloons or above saloons, and men were drinking and losing their paycheck. Families were suffering from the, the good news side of the thing. It made sense that if you killed wagering, then that would all go away. Unfortunately, the tracks relied upon part of the handle. And so if you killed wagering, you killed the track. August Belmont, for all of his money, was only able to pay off the New York legislature for 1 year before they ended up outlawing wagering in New York, and Belmont track closes. And in fact, every state in the country except Illinois and Kentucky have outlawed wagering. And from over 600 tracks just before the Civil War in the country, we're down to four thoroughbred tracks. I mean, they're harness tracks and otherwise, but four thoroughbred. And two of those, Lexington and Louisville, are right here. And the question is now before the Kentucky General Assembly. Do we outlaw wagering in Kentucky? Well, about this time, an Englishman was appointed to Good Shepherd, and they were working that their church on South Broadway had burned in 1888, and he was trying to raise money and support to build a new church. Now the world of politics and the world of religion intercede, and there is a big meeting at the Fayette County Courthouse, the old courthouse now, to hear debate and give feedback to the representatives and senators going to Frankfurt to vote on this, and he attends. He is the only minister to speak, and he tells people he knew firsthand the evils of bookmaking, which is the alternative to mechanized pari-mutuel wagering. He said, with a bookmaker, the crooked owner can bet that his horse will lose and will win his bet that way. He said, you can't do that with the pari-mutuels. Before I went into the ministry, being an Englishman, I used to occasionally go to the races. And also being an Englishman, I occasionally bet on them. The greatest fun I found in doing it was catching the bookmaker out of line, which is to say, his odds had gotten out of line with the other bookmakers, and so you could lay off part of your bet between two different bookies and spread your risk on the horses you were betting on. He said, you can't do that with the pari-mutuel. And let me tell you, the pari-mutuel machine at that time looked like an overgrown version of a grandfather clock. At each betting window were a series of levers and gears. There were chains that went up and around and back into the back where the master team was that would change the odds based on the bets, which is how it happens today. But it was just, the odds were for everybody. It wasn't just you and a bookie making a bet. Well, the legislature, in fact, passed the bill to outlaw wagering. It was vetoed by the governor. And when the veto override came up, the veto was sustained by one vote. And the Fayette County representative claimed to be that one vote, although obviously there were several others. The grateful horseman offered the good reverend $50,000 and a new car. He turned it down. They continued to try to find some way to thank him. And he finally said, look, build me a church. And they did. And contributions from the horse industry all over the country came into Lexington to help build the Church of the Good Shepherd. And this is not just the owner who donated a thoroughbred racehorse to be auctioned. We're very familiar with that kind of notion around here, but in other places that was amazing. A horse was donated to build a church, yes. And even stable boys would send in 10 cents, 50 cents, all because their jobs were saved by the persuasive statements of Reverend Settle. And today in the narthex of the church is a plaque with the following dedication: to the glory of God, this church is given to him by the lovers of the horse from all over the country as a token of appreciation of their father's goodness to his children. So, sometime before you forget this, go drive downtown and say that you have been to the church built by horses. And I will tell you, the congregants are very proud of that association themselves. Now we're going to talk about the Oaks and the Derby. The Derby. This is Lord Stanley, the 12th Earl of Derby, as they pronounce it over there. He was a horse breeder, among other things. His colors were black with a white cap. Now, if you know anything about silks, the simpler the colors are, the older the silk is. And as more people come on, they put a circle. You can have black silks with a white cap, but now you've got to put a red circle on it or some other design, and you get these fanciful designs we have today, mainly because you've got to be different to be approved, which not only helps the bettors, but it helps the guy calling the race as he looks around to see who's blue silks, and he knows those. The earldom is centuries old. In 1845, a young upstart by the name of Henry Tudor was challenging Richard III for the crown of England. Thomas Stanley and his brother were up on a hilltop watching the Battle of Bosworth Field was being fought, waiting to see who was going to win and then throw their support to the winning side. And when it became clear that Tudor was prevailing over Richard III, the Stanleys came roaring down with their mounted troops, crashed into the line of King Richard, broke it, and effectively turned the battle. Not surprisingly, Henry, now Henry VII, rewarded Thomas with an earldom, the Earl of Derby. And that, of course, comes with great lands and crops and the whole thing. Well, in 1778, he's having a dinner party at his country estate. And when I say country estate, think Downton Abbey, okay, because he's got a big mansion down in downtown London and so forth. But he's out there at the country estate. They're out on the lawn, he and other area nobles, and they're talking horses. And they decided that there was not a good race for three-year-old fillies, and they ought to start one at the local track, of which, of course, the Earl was the main sponsor. And so they ran a race that year, and it was successful. It was well attended. It was a good race, and they decided to continue it, and they would name it after the Earl's country estate, which was called the Oaks. So that's how the first Oaks, got its name. The next year, they were talking again at the annual party and decided they needed a race for two-year-olds. And they decided to do this, and legend has it that the Earl of Derby and Sir Charles Bunbury, who was head of the Jockey Club, were the two most senior titled men there, and they couldn't decide which one to name it after, so they decided on a flip of the coin, and so that year they ran the first Derby. It ran first in 1780. Now, everybody copied these successful races, and that's how you had the Warsaw Derby and the Russian Oaks and the Italian Oaks and the Spanish Derby. The French called it one of these long French names that I can't pronounce, but it was the same idea. You have a race for two-year-olds, have a race for three-year-old fillies. In 1935, somebody got around to inviting the incumbent Earl of Derby to the Derby in Louisville. And so Sir Edward Stanley was invited to come to Kentucky. He landed in New York City, got on a private railroad car owned by the owner of Elmendorf Farm, ran down to Washington, D.C. to have dinner with the president, on into Lexington. This is the entrance to Elmendorf, and at the back, the remnant of the Elmendorf private railroad depot. Elmendorf lay on the Paris Pike, still does, where there was an interurban trolley going to Paris from Lexington. And you had the L&N track that ran the back boundary of the farm, and he had a private car. So they just left the train, dropped the private car off at the depot, where they hooked a wagon to it and pulled it up to the mansion. There was a spur connecting from the railroad track to the farm. So when the Earl came over on the Aquitania, which is a sister ship to the Titanic, but a year later. And so the Aquitania had been retrofitted with a lot more safety features and was not so egotistical in its operation. They met with President Hoover, came to Lexington, came to the downtown train depot on South Broadway. That station has burned. Got onto the interurban, took the interurban up to Elmendorf and into Elmendorf. He stayed there for 3 nights, and then they hooked the private car to the L&N from the back, went to Louisville, and for the first and only time, the namesake attended the race. There's Elmendorf itself. A later owner thought the property taxes were too high and tore down the mansion to save money. But this is what the interior looked like. And the Earl of Derby, as he was leaving and saying all wonderful things about Thoroughbred, and he was a successful breeder and racer himself, so he knew the industry. And he said this was the only time he had seen Thoroughbred racing on dirt. All the English tracks were turf tracks, and the U.S. tracks had not yet developed turf track. Now, this is the so-called Woodlawn Vase. This is what you get if you win the Preakness. The original trophy, this is a photograph of it, is 3 feet of solid silver designed by Tiffany's of New York. Between 1917 and 1953, it was a traveling trophy by the winner of the Preakness. He brought it back each year and then handed over custody to whoever won it. The next time, in 1953, Alfred Gwynn Vanderbilt Stables won the Preakness, but his wife refused the responsibility of taking the trophy home. She didn't want to have the armed guards, and this was very public, right? Everybody knew that 3 feet of solid silver was going to the Vanderbilt house. And she didn't want the responsibility, didn't want to have the armed guards, didn't want to have the increase in insurance premiums. And so the vase was retired to the Baltimore Museum of Art, where it sits today, and a 14-inch replica, also sterling, is given to the winner, and slightly smaller replicas are given to the jockey and trainer. But at the beginning of my talk, I told you this was the Kentucky Preakness. And now I'm going to tell you why. In 1859, a race course was established near Louisville called Woodlawn. Robert Alexander of Woodford County commissioned a vase as a traveling trophy of the Woodlawn Stakes. That trophy, commissioned by a Woodford County horseman to be given to the winner of a Jefferson County, Kentucky race. Thomas Moore of Woodford County won the stakes in 1862, and he took it to his farm. And when the Union and Confederate armies were crossing back and forth over central Kentucky, he buried it at the farm, along with his own family silver, for safekeeping. An alternate story is it was buried in the infield at Woodlawn. I don't think that's as probable, because it would have been carried back by Thomas Moore to Woodford County. Once the war was over, he dug up the trophy and carried it back to Woodlawn Racecourse the next year, as he was obliged to do, where they had a track. The track closed after the 62 season. It reopened in 1865 and raced for five more years until 1870, when for financial reasons the track had to close. The winners that year were brothers from Brooklyn who took the trophy back east, but retained the spirit of a traveling trophy, and it moved from track to track, stakes race to stakes race, until it landed there at the Preakness. But it is a Kentucky trophy. And you know this guy. This is Henry Clay. Said he'd rather be right than president, ran for president unsuccessfully three times, instigated the War of 1812, and then negotiated the treaty that ended it in 1814. Great promoter of Kentucky hemp, to the extent that Kentucky hemp at one point supplied the majority of rope for the U.S. Navy. Great politician. But he was a better breeder than he was a politician. He got together with four other men to buy a stallion from Virginia by the name of Buzzard, like the vulture, the Buzzard. Buzzard had been bred in England. He had a successful, moderately successful racing career, brought to Virginia as a stallion. And Richard Vimont, who has spent many years practicing equine law here in Kentucky and elsewhere, describes this agreement as the first modern syndicate agreement as we know them today in the thoroughbred industry. It was customary for you to breed for your own purposes. And you might breed to a friend or a son-in-law's mare's, but basically it was a personal thing. Clay and his syndicate, literally, bought Buzzard for the exclusive and intentional purpose of selling breeding seasons to other horse owners, which is what is done today. And Buzzard had a dislocated hip, and he was blind in one eye. And in spite of that, he had a very successful breeding career at standing at Ashland Stud here in Lexington. So much so that for the 2018 Kentucky Derby, and I quickly state that I have not done the research for this year's Derby, but every horse in the last year's Kentucky Derby counted Buzzard amongst its ancestors. Now, it helps that one of the offspring was Majestic Prince and another one was Northern Dancer, and that's why. But you go about eight generations back from those winners and you find Buzzard. Little pitch coming next year. If Peter Brackney and I get our work done, we'll be coming out with the History Lover's Guide to Lexington and Central Kentucky. Ideally, it will come out in time for everybody who wants to come to the Breeders' Cup next year to get a handle on what to do when they're not at the track. Chapter 2 is going to be What's Outside My Window? And it will tell you, when you're in a Lexington hotel, what you're looking at. Because if you're on the west side of 21C, you're looking at the old courthouse, Cheapside Park, on towards Victorian Square. And if you're in one of the upper rooms, you can see Henry Clay's monument in the cemetery. But if you're on the east side of 21C, you don't get that view. You see the northeast part of Lexington where the track used to be, where Isaac Murphy Park, located where his residence was, and looking on east over the trees to Henry Clay's Ashland. And so we will do that for all of the hotels, at least all the major hotels in Lexington, and then go into a little bit of history about each of the historic sites. We'll group by churches, by farms, by architecture, by people. It's kind of a good, as the History Press in Charleston has that series, The History Lover's Guide, and they contracted with Peter and myself to do this. The Hidden History of Horse Racing is available in our area bookstores. It is on and off available on Amazon, depending on their connection with the press. It's at the Keeneland gift shop at the track and downtown. And if I can figure out how to build an e-commerce website at Aukerman.com, I'll have it on sale there. I do have a few copies here to sell, and I know at least one gentleman has brought his copy to be signed. So with that, I'll thank you and ask if there are any questions. Laura.
I have one. So when you were talking about Wingfield taking the Czar's horses to France, did he literally, he had to walk those across the country, and then those horses bred, and are their progeny racing now as well?
I assume they are, yes. I have not tracked down exactly what he did with his horses, but yeah. I mean, there was another story we talk about in the book is there came a time when American horses were beating English horses, which hurt the ego and the pocketbook of the Englishman, and they changed their jockey club rule to say you had to absolutely prove ancestry back to the foundation mares and the three Arabian sires of Charles III. And most American horses could not prove that. Even Man of War did not have the documentation to satisfy the English Jockey Club. So American racing in England came to a standstill at the same time that wagering was being outlawed. And all the big breeding operations started selling their stock because there was no place to race, there was no money to win, there was nobody to buy their horses except, again, John E. Madden, who was buying when everybody else was selling, and the foundation of Hamburg Farm as a racing operation was built off buying good mares and good horses from guys who were getting out of the business at rock-bottom prices. And Madden was completely confident the race would come back. It did. And that's the other story. But yes, as far as I know, there were no vanning companies in 1917. And I'm not sure, but even the notion of vanning a horse was very new and only done by a couple of dukes who could afford to have special carts built to carry the horses. So yes, he walked them.
I mean, it just seems incredible to have 260 horses that I'm just picturing like cattle drives out west or something.
I'm sure it was a lot like a cattle drive. It was cross country, cross terrible country after World War I. And for that reason, probably very little interference. All the governments had a whole lot more to worry about than a herd of horses coming through. And for all I know, herds of horses might have been ordinary things prior to World War I. That's what makes history so interesting. You know, you think you've got the story, and then someone says, well, what about this? It's, oh, gosh, I need to go look that up. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Surprise about saying about how big horse racing was in Russia for the revolution. That makes me think of I worked at Keeneland about racing. One of the gentlemen I worked with, he's at a farm kind of business in the United Kingdom. It's a very small farm. He told me that they ship a lot of the Russians still buy a lot of lower priced horses. And he says they ship a lot of them over there.
Really?
And I was shocked because I'd never heard of racing in Russia at all. So they must apparently, somewhere, I don't know if they're racing in Russia now, but maybe in other countries, other places around there. It just shocked me. So when you mentioned this, that it was big at one time.
Well, it would be interesting to know if there's still a Warsaw Derby and
yeah,
Russian
I
Oaks.
Many of that, until he told me that they were shipping a lot of, they buy a lot of the lower priced horses.
Well, I'm glad you came today because you just validated my story, so got a second source. Yes, Alan?
Can you tell us about some of the rogues and scoundrels that you've come across in your research in the history of the horse business?
Not really, no. I was an active equine attorney for a number of years and came across some very interesting characters that way, but the research I was doing really didn't focus on personalities. It was focusing on the old tracks. I mean, I'm sure you all have heard we used to have racing on Main Street in Lexington until that was banned, and I haven't found the anti-gambling ordinance yet, but the placement of tracks just outside of the city limits tells me that there must have been an anti-gambling ordinance. All right, well, Alan, I will turn it back to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, one more time for Foster Aukerman. Thank you all for coming today. We do have some refreshments over there. We have bottled water and some cookies, and Foster will be here to talk about his book and hopefully sell a few copies. And if you have one to do an interview, or an autograph, so much the better. Thank you all very much for coming today.